What to do about threats from North Korea? Should the Senate follow the lead of Connecticut and pass tougher gun control laws? What messages did voters send in this week's spring election in Wisconsin? We'll ask our guests and we'll ask you too in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Friday, April 5th. If you would like to add a story to our Week in Review list, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Matt Rothschild is with us. He is publisher of The Progressive Magazine. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, Joy. Good to see you.
Good to have you back. Chris Lotto is also with us, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a Republican campaign consultant. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Joy and Matthew.
Boy, I'm glad I don't live up north right now. 7 inches of snow expected in northern Wisconsin tonight with sleet and mixed precipitation in other parts of the state. Is spring ever going to come, Chris Lotto? That's my first question.
I love your tackling the tough stuff right out of the gate.
Yeah.
I think that's crazy. I mean, I finally saw in my area in southeast Wisconsin, the snow has finally gone in the last few days. And the idea that we're already well into April and they're going to see 7 inches up north is, they talk about the endless summer. This is the endless winter we're having
here. Right. And Matt, you enjoy it though, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I could see it get warmer in a little bit and be happy about that. But I do like the gradual spring as opposed to the crazy hot spring we had last year,
yeah,
which was kind of scary.
That's true. Well, let's start with one of the most serious issues out there right now, North Korea. North Korea has reportedly moved some medium-range missile launchers, signifying a possible looming test. And South Korea's defense minister says these particular missiles don't have the range to hit the U.S. mainland, so it's not really clear why the North is doing this. Matt Rothschild, what is North Korea doing? Is saying that it's prepared to attack the United States.
Well, this is a really kind of frightening situation that harkens back to the Cuban Missile Crisis days and years and decades that we thought we had passed now, this nuclear nightmare that has been looming over our heads. And it's still with us, unfortunately. And that's a serious problem. And I think it's a fault in part of the U.S. government for not pushing nuclear disarmament, universal nuclear disarmament, including our own, but getting other countries to disarm as we're supposed to do under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. North Korea, let's look at it. I've been in South Korea. I was there about 20 years ago. And there was a feeling back then that the Korean Peninsula was going to unite, that North Korea and South Korea were going to merge. And we're a ways from that. I still think that's going to happen in the next 30 years or so if we can get through this crisis and crises like this. I think the Obama administration made a mistake by increasing its own belligerent stance by sending B-2 bombers and B-52 bombers on a mock bombing raid across the Korean Peninsula. I mean, that was a way of heightening the tensions there. Kim Jong-un is a new leader there, the son and grandson of Korean dictators, and he is rattling the nuclear sabers in a really reckless way. I think it's time, and I think the Obama administration finally has realized this, that it's time to lower the rhetoric so that there isn't a catastrophic nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula that might also inflame Japan. And, there's no winners in a nuclear war.
Yeah. Is the U.S. Handling this properly, Chris Lotto?
Well, I think Matt summarized it well, that initially there was this sort of ratcheting up of rhetoric on the U.S. side, and they seem to have since backed down a little bit. I mean, on the face of it, it's scary when you see, the North Korea, looking to attack new U.S. with nukes. I mean, when you see those headlines, it's frightening. But I think as you dig a little deeper, it seems to be more saber-rattling without any real serious muscle or even intent behind it. So the question becomes, well, what's really going on here? The Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says North Korea does have the nuclear weapons and it does have the delivery system, but it seems as you read about this and think about it a little deeper that nobody really actually expects North Korea to launch an attack, because that would guarantee retaliation on a massive scale. And the number of warheads that the U.S. has would frankly put the North Korean arsenal to shame. They don't have as much as they'd like the world to think they do have. You know, we don't know much about the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at this point. He's a young person. I mean, there's been some questioning in the media about whether he's fully sane, frankly. One line of thinking out there is that, you know, his threats are really meant to appease military hardliners in his nation, because that's the base of support he needs, because otherwise North Korea is really not in very good shape. It's a poor nation, and people over there are struggling. So is this part of an effort to kind of build a power base of support among the military? That's one line of thinking here. So it obviously remains to be seen where this goes, but you know, I think it seems, at least in the eyes of the U.S. government, and they're ratcheting back their rhetoric and some of their activities, seems to show that you know, this is more about posturing and that there's not an imminent threat here. Mm-hmm. But it does create instability in the region, for sure.
What is it that Kim Jong-un wants, Matt?
Well, I haven't talked to him, so I don't know exactly. But, I mean, it's, you know, they're isolated. They're under very hard, tough sanctions. They want a loosening of sanctions so that they could import more food and energy supplies. And it's absurd to me that, you know, we have President Obama, who, when he was running for president the first time around, said he'd go meet with any leader around the world without conditions. And now he won't meet with Kim Jong-un or even send John Kerry, who's going to be in South Korea next week, over there to meet with him. I mean, how crazy is it that the only person in the United States who meets with Kim Jong-un is Dennis Rodman? I mean, we need to really heighten the diplomacy here. The problem with these nuclear saber rattlings is these things can spin out of control. If you remember back in Cuban Missile Crisis, or reports of the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a Soviet submarine that was just prepared to launch on its own because it thought that the war had started already. So it was going to launch its weapons against the United States, and then, you know, all hell would have broken loose and none of us would be here right now. And when you have the South Korean president saying it's up to the military commanders, they can do what they want if they feel threatened or if they are under attack, you know, we're in a situation that's really hair trigger, and that's not where we should be after the fall of the Soviet Union. There's no reason for having these weapons around and threatening, you know, essentially global destruction.
Yeah. Are you, Chris, confident in the abilities of John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, to resolve this situation peacefully?
That's kind of a loaded question, Joy. Yeah. You know, they have to be. I mean, for the good of the world and for the good of U.S. and our interests, they have to know what they're doing. So we have to rely on them to deliver for us. And I think that you know, they are recognizing this, I think, for what it is. They took their initial actions, which were involved some chest thumping, and now they're backing off a little bit. You know, Matt raised the point about President Obama saying that he would be willing to meet with anyone without conditions, and he's not meeting with Kim Jong-un now. And I think that's a smart thing to do right now, because I think that was a naive thing to promise in the first place, that he would meet anywhere, anytime without conditions. And I think he's realized over time that that's, you know, maybe not something he can honor in every case. And I think this is one of them right now. I think that things, you know, need to cool down, whether it's through a combination of diplomatic measures or letting this thing sort of play itself out. Because again, we do know that North Korea does not have the nuclear might that it would like to portray itself as having.
Well, let's move on to another issue, guns and gun control measures. Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy signed into law this week sweeping new restrictions on weapons and large-capacity ammunition magazines. It's, of course, in response to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in December. Meanwhile, President Obama was in Colorado this week, praising Colorado for that state's recent move to expand gun background checks and to restrict these ammunition magazines. So, Matt Rothschild, do you think this should happen anytime soon in Wisconsin? Looks like the states are doing this rather than Congress.
Well, I think it should happen in both places. I mean, it is interesting. You had these mass killings in Connecticut and Colorado, and those state legislatures and governors responded appropriately. We had our own mass killing at the Sikh Temple less than a year ago down in Oak Creek, and nothing's going on here. And that's a real failing of our own political system here in Wisconsin. But there's a failing of the national congressional leadership, too, because we've had these horrible things happen. And you know, banning semi-automatic weapons and banning large-cap magazines seems a really logical, obvious thing to do. Not that it's going to solve everything about murders by guns in this country, but it would certainly be a sensible response to the tragedies that we saw, and those aren't happening. I mean, it looks like, you know, Harry Reid has just taken those things off the table. Harry Reid, by the way, is supported by the NRA, has gotten a lot of support by the NRA in the past. And you know, I wish that the Democratic Party would have stood up to the NRA in this instance. It's interesting. Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, said, if you're afraid of the NRA, you shouldn't be in the Senate.
What do you think of this, Chris?
Well, Matt, I think, is right in the sense that, Democrats right now are in about as good a shape as they can be in terms of their power and control in Washington to get something done. But the fact is, you know, the NRA is often portrayed as, you know, it's a conservative Republican thing, but it's not. I mean, they have supporters on, in both political parties, which is part of the reason why it makes gun control measures, you know, so difficult to get through. And we're seeing that right now. You could definitely make the case that, after the mass shootings we have seen, if ever there was a time to push gun control measures, through Congress and get it signed by the president, now is that time. And it seems as though the wherewithal is kind of fading in Washington to actually get something done.
I mean, I can't believe we aren't even going to get universal background checks. I mean, a majority of NRA members themselves want that, but the NRA leadership, which isn't representative of all gun owners and not a majority on this issue, is fighting even that one. And what a terrible, grotesque lost opportunity this would end up being if we can't get any sensible gun control after these tragedies we've seen over the last year.
Yeah, our poll and many polls showed more than 80% backing universal background checks. Chris Lotto, can you explain why that's so objectionable to the NRA?
Well, I think the fear is, that laws like this target law-abiding citizens more than anything. I mean, pretty much by definition, when a criminal shoots somebody, they're engaging in criminal activity, which would suggest more often than not that they didn't come by those guns lawfully in the first place. I think the NRA and a number of its supporters fear what the government would do with that information once they collect it. I think that's one of the main objections there, and it is seen as an infringement on people's freedom, the right to bear arms. And I know we have an ongoing discussion over how you define that and what that really means. But, the NRA and its supporters really view that as unconditional as we can get. But that's the way it should be in the U.S.
Yeah, as talk about gun restrictions is in the news, at least in various states, gun enthusiasts are apparently buying guns and ammo in huge numbers out of fears that their Second Amendment rights are going to be stomped on. Are these gun supporters right to do this, Chris?
Well, sure. It's their right to voice their opinions, their feelings, their fears. You know, we saw I think this was a couple of weeks ago, and you may have missed. You may have talked about this, Joy, and I missed it. But there's a very popular gun show, let's say impresario in Wisconsin. He organizes a lot of these events, and he said that read this in the paper. I saw it on TV that President Obama has been the greatest salesman for guns that he's seen since he got in the business, meaning that, President Obama, for whatever reason, is driving gun sales up, whether it's through a combination of folks being afraid that he's going to try to take their guns or impose punitive measures or extreme limits on the kinds of guns you can buy. But, gun sales are up, and he credits President Obama for it. It is certainly within the rights of people to voice their opinions. I mean, that's pretty much the definition of what America is. Whether there's room to ultimately come to some sort of compromise and get some of these measures in place, remains to be seen. But when you don't even have Democrats in Washington pushing for it in the leadership, then you've got a real problem. And will you see anything on the federal level? It remains a question mark.
Man. I mean, no one says people shouldn't be able to express their opinions. The question is whether people should be able to buy semi-automatic weapons in these large cap magazines and have, military guns in the hands of, everybody on the street who wants them. And it's just amazing that we can't solve that problem. There's been an immense amount of hysteria whipped up by the NRA and the far right on this issue. There are regulations when you drive a car and there should be regulations when you own a gun. I mean, this is real obvious to me, and I think to most people in this country, that we need to do something about the gun problem. There are other problems with the gun problem, too. I mean, you know, of the 31,000 people killed by guns every year, 19,000 are people who commit suicide. And we need to do something about suicide prevention. And certainly having guns all over the place help people kill themselves, but they're not killing themselves with semi-automatic weapons. So there's something else that needs to be done, too.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking this week with Matt Rothschild, publisher of The Progressive, and Chris Lotto, a Republican campaign consultant. And we welcome your input, the issues you would like them to discuss, at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk about the messages that Wisconsin voters sent when they went to the polls on Tuesday of this week, and much more here on The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Be sure to stay tuned. Later today, it's your views on the news after 4 o'clock. You can call in and talk about the story of the week that meant the most to you during your views on the news every Friday after 4. This is our regular Friday Week in Review, when I talk with two guests from different viewpoints about the news of the week. Today we have with us Chris Lotto and Matt Rothschild. And here's a story that just broke this morning. President Obama reportedly is going to be proposing cuts to Social Security in his upcoming budget as an attempt to compromise with Republicans on the budget. That's not going to make Democrats very happy, I imagine, Matt Rothschild.
No, it's disgusting. I mean, it's a huge betrayal by President Obama of the people who elected him the first time and the people who elected him the second time, who were progressives, supporters of labor, supporters of Social Security, supporters of Medicare, and people who thought he was going to defend Social Security because that's what he campaigned on. And then for him to already be willing to throw that overboard is just, it gives you a sense that he's kind of rudderless here and without spine, and he's the worst bargainer ever. I mean, he bargains with himself before he bargains with the Republicans, like he did on health care reform, too. And it's just outrageous that elderly people in this country and disabled people and veterans are going to be able to get less than they are right now from the government. It's not like they're getting rich. I mean, look at Social Security. Recipients get under $15,000 a year on average. They're not getting rich. And for two-thirds of Americans on Social Security, that's the lion's share of their income total, under $15,000 from Social Security. And he's going to make those people do with less. That's the whole idea by changing the calculation on the Consumer Price Index, the so-called chained CPI. There's no decent rationale for that on any human level. And there are ways to fix Social Security without taking it out of the hides of the recipients who aren't doing well anyway. You could lift the cap on Social Security taxes so that, you know, Warren Buffett is paying a little bit more than he is right now. And you could solve that problem with the Warren Buffetts of this world. But that's not happening. And as a consequence, elderly people, disabled people, veterans are going to get hurt.
Yeah. According to a senior administration official, the budget that President Obama will offer to Congress next Wednesday would reduce the deficit by $1.8 trillion over 10 years. And it includes a revised inflation adjustment called the chained CPI that would curb or cut cost of living increases in Social Security. So, what do you think of this, Chris Lotto?
I'm immediately suspicious. So, I mean, look, it's a proposal. It's a start in the process, much like Governor Walker's budget, which I would imagine we're going to touch on later. You know, it's meant as a starting point. I wonder how much of this is trying to call out Republicans to see if they are truly serious about deficit reduction and how they want to get there, and whether they are serious about wanting to impose these cuts, knowing that it really will be something that will be met with a lot of criticism in a lot of quarters. Now, the fact is, you know, Washington has a spending problem and needs to deal with, you know, a deficit and spending that has just spiraled out of control. But now it's going to become, is this the best way to get it done? You know, another part of this, again, is President Obama proposing more tax increases as part of the plan. Again, as we've seen this morning with the economic numbers coming out, you know, our country is still not recovered. I mean, there are still people looking for work and more people dropping off the radar because they've stopped looking for work. You know, we're not out of the woods yet. So the idea that we're going to raise taxes again is to me, not a very smart idea. But this is, again, very early in the process, and it's obvious from Matt's reaction that a lot of folks on the left are going to be furious with the president on this. So it'll be interesting to see where he's going with this, because I frankly don't take it seriously, or I think he has other motives here.
Let me get a call in on this. Ronaldo in Black River Falls. Hello.
Hello. I just want to start by saying I'm an independent, so I'm either not with either party. I believe it's a trap for the Republicans. I really do. I don't think this guy means anything that he says. He also stated in the campaign that he wasn't going to allow the sequester to happen, and it happened. He said, close Gitmo. You didn't close Gitmo. So anything this president here does, it's all to make him look good or make the Republicans look bad. He needs that Congress. He needs the House of Representatives to pass anything.
All right. Well, thank you, Ronaldo. So, Matt, is this a trap for Republicans?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a trap for Democrats, and I think Obama's leading them into this. And I'm not surprised by this, because let's remember that a year ago, or a little more, 2 years ago, that President Obama was willing to reach this grand bargain with John Boehner of the Republicans in the House, which would have essentially done the same thing. And also, President Obama's first director of the Office of Management and Budget, Peter Orszag, had proposed this when he came in right at the beginning of the first term of the Obama administration. So it's not a surprise, but it's in contradiction with campaign pledges that the president made. But it's in keeping with kind of his characteristic willingness to compromise and want to be this great guy in the middle, listening to some of the mainstream pundits in Washington like David Brooks, and maybe he wants him over for cocktails. I don't know. But I wish he would stand by progressive principles and represent the people who put him in office rather than trying to get praise from the mainstream chatterers.
We'll get to state budget issues and state election issues coming up a little bit later in the program, but let's stick to the national budget right now. President Obama this week said he would return 5% of his salary to the Treasury in light of the automatic spending cuts known as sequestration. Obama makes $400,000 a year, so a 5% cut amounts to about $1,700 per month. President says he wants to share in the sacrifice that government employees are having to make because of furloughs and budget cuts. Do you like this, Matt Rothschild?
Well, I think it's an appropriate gesture. It's a gesture, after all. I mean, he's making $400,000, and now we'll be making $380,000. He's not suffering. But, you know, in contrast, you have senators and representatives who are constantly giving themselves pay raises. So I think he deserves at least a little credit for this.
Yeah. Is this just a gimmick, Chris Lotto?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a simple answer. I mean, it's a token gesture. It's nice. I guess if it makes some people feel good, then that's great. It is what it is. I mean, I'm sure once he's out of office, he'll be able to recover that in one afternoon on the speaking circuit. So, you know, don't cry for President Obama.
I wanted to ask you both about how close we are to a comprehensive immigration deal. Chris Lotto?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like real progress is being made. I think one of the outstanding issues that remains to be addressed, how it's addressed and at what point in the process it's addressed, is border enforcement. And that seems to be a real sticking point. And I think it has to be addressed in tandem with any other reform. You know, without proper border enforcement, the plans that are on the table right now mean that we will essentially be legalizing, you know, millions of people in this new effort. And yet, at the same time, if we're not dealing with border enforcement, one of the key problems, we're going to be seeing, you know, more illegals, you know, coming over the border. So what problem have we solved? We've taken care of the ones who have been here for a while now. And in a few years, we'll have the same problem all over again. You know, and this occurred back in the 1980s. You know, you had amnesty granted, but there was never real border enforcement to coincide with that. And so, you know, we're living with that bad decision today. So, you know, for example, outside San Diego, apparently there are border sections that have, I think, triple fencing. And apparently it's been a real success. So I think that as we talk about the legalization process, for illegal immigrants, You know, there has to be a focus on a border control plan, and right now it seems like that may not happen. And, you know, really, it's without trying to get the original problem under control, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg.
Yeah, the White House this week said it was encouraged by recent progress on efforts to overhaul immigration. The White House spokesperson Jay Carney cited positive comments from a bipartisan cast of senators over the weekend. He did not comment, though, on cautionary remarks from Senator Marco Rubio, one of the key participants in those negotiations, who said, hold on, we're not ready yet. Matt, your thoughts?
Well, I think there is progress, and that's a good thing. I mean, and also there's just a lot of confusion or just misinformation about immigration from Mexico and other parts of Latin America. And it's not just, these people who are coming here illegally and taking advantage of our system. Our economy would screech to a halt if we didn't have immigration from Mexico and from other parts of Latin America, whether people come here legally or not. And I think we need to recognize that. And I think that's what's happening, by and large, both with members of Congress. And also, you see this agreement between the AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that they seem to be in accord with a program that would allow people to come in here and work. And the biggest thing for me is offering a pathway to citizenship. This is something that President Obama talked about during the campaign, and certainly Mitt Romney did not talk that way. He wanted people to self-deport. My favorite comment about the whole election was that he self-deported from the White House, one analyst on CNN said. But, you know, both Republicans and Democrats are talking about this pathway to citizenship, 13 years. It's certainly not putting people to the front of the line.
You know, here's one that both of you have journalism backgrounds, and the Associated Press, which normally reports on the news, is making news this week, saying that the AP will stop using the term illegal immigrant. The AP says illegal should only be used to describe an action, not a person. What do you think of this? Is this a wise decision, Matt?
Yeah, I was totally in favor of it. And actually, congratulations have to go out to Color Lines magazine out in California and the editors there who've been championing this move now for 4 or 5 years. I know some people might think this is petty or political correctness or whatever, but, you know, names matter. And that's why we've stopped referring to African-Americans as Negroes or colored people. And no person is really illegal. So just to call someone an illegal is to deny, in some sense, that person is a human being and has rights just like the rest of us.
Yeah, so instead we should say something along the lines of immigrants who are in this country illegally, or people who are in this country.
People who came here illegally, yeah. People who came here without proper documentation.
Yeah. So what do you think of this, Chris?
Yeah, this is obviously interesting because I do have a journalism background, and obviously, you know, words matter. I mean, unless you're an advocacy journalist who supports a particular worldview or political perspective and you're not shy about it, you know, reporters always have to walk that line and strive for balance in the words you use. So a choice like the word illegal immigrant, I understand how to some that could seem like a loaded term. And I do think it's interesting that AP, said in what is acceptable alternative language, it still includes the word illegal, but it just would be as you folks have already pointed out, you know, folks who are in the country illegally or something like that, instead of assigning the phrase illegal immigrant. On the other hand, this does kind of smack of that PC, let's take the sting out of what this is. But again, if AP is saying, well, look, we're still going to, you know, tag the activity as being illegal, then I'm not so bothered by it.
Tim and Ladysmith is with us now. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think this immigration and illegal immigrant, unfortunately, AP is, you know, smoking something with this nonsense. I think the big thing, I have friends who are Mexican. I go to Mexico a lot on mission trip, and one of the problems with immigration in Mexico is far too costly for people to become citizens. It takes far too long. There's far too much red tape. It seems that immigration seems to be more about making money off of people than actually getting them to become citizens. So we're going to have to streamline and get the bureaucracy out of immigration. Second thing, we have to secure our borders. And the third thing, I don't know what's so complicated about setting a date and saying all illegals have to register by that date. If they're, give them 3 years. If they're not registered, then you're booted out of the country, period. That should be easy enough for people to do and get them on some kind of payroll.
All right, Tim. You're giving us a 3-point plan here, but Matt, what about that?
Well, the thing that Tim said that I really agree with is the red tape and the bureaucracy. And there are some people who've been in this country who've been trying to become citizens who are waiting 20 years, who've waited 20 years, and that's absurd. You know, it's hard to reunite a family if you can't be here legally, and it's going to take you 20 years to get here. So I think he's absolutely right about that.
Do you think he's right about that, Chris?
Yeah, the bureaucracy is clearly a problem, and when it takes that long, it's absurd. But the caller also hit on some other points as part of his 3-point plan that I would agree with as well. I mean, the border enforcement, as I mentioned earlier, has got to be a component of what we're going to do here moving forward, or the problem will not go away.
Chris Lotto and Matt Rothschild are our guests for this edition of The Week in Review. We'll turn our attention to state issues after this. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time now for our Week in Review quiz. Chicago-based critic Roger Ebert died yesterday at 70 after a long battle with cancer. As you may know, Ebert was a longtime co-host along with Gene Siskel of the syndicated TV show At the Movies. In today's Week in Review quiz, our question is, how did Siskel and Ebert traditionally sign off each episode of At the Movies? 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call if you care to answer. We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers and offer you a book that we have featured on the program recently. 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll announce the winner and the answer at the end of the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Matt Rothschild, publisher of the Progressive Magazine, and Chris Lotto, a Republican campaign consultant, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, about the week's top news stories. And let's turn our attention to the state of Wisconsin. It was Election Day on Tuesday in Wisconsin. Voters reelected Supreme Court Justice Pat Rogensack to another 10-year term. She defeated her challenger, Marquette University Law School professor Ed Falone, 57% to 43%. Voters also reelected the state school superintendent, Tony Evers, to another term. He beat the challenger, State Representative Don Pridemore, 61 to 39%. Let's start with the Supreme Court first. Chris Lotto, I'm guessing you think voters got that one right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, none of the statewide results were surprising. I think, you know, one quick little detour here. I think that, you know, with voter turnout being at 19%, that's unfortunate, because particularly in the state Supreme Court race, you're talking about, you know, something that has real impact on state policy, and it's a real shame that you could get fewer than 1 in 5 folks in Wisconsin to turn out to vote, because that is certainly an election that matters. Now, that said, the results are not at all surprising. I think Justice Rogensack has a record that she's served the state well for the past 10 years, and there was really no compelling reason for folks to vote her out. I mean, she has a level of experience on the bench that Professor Falone did not. There's always the power of incumbency. There was a rather weak effort by Falone supporters to make this race the umpteenth referendum on Scott Walker, on the right-wing judiciary, on the Tea Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that didn't fly. You know, and the idea that the well-documented conflicts among the justices behind closed doors are somehow all Justice Rogensack's fault, that's bunk as well, and voters saw, you know, through those arguments. You know, Professor Falone was, you know, obvious from the results, was unable to fire up his base, and in a low turnout race, the incumbent enjoyed a clear advantage, and again, these results are not surprising.
Your take on the Supreme Court justice results, Matt?
Well, I think it's, you know, the power of incumbency, the power of money, the power of the argument about experience. I think all three of those things held true with the superintendent's race, too, but here, the money was just enormous, much greater than in the school superintendent's race. Rogensack and her supporters outspent Falone by more than 5-1. Outside groups came in for Rogan's Act, you know, some of the old standards, the Club for Growth, the Koch brothers, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And then with direct funding, I was just at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign website, direct funding, Rogan's Act raised $966,000, Ed Filone's $210,000. And you look at it, people from the school vouchers crowd, insurance companies, the Beloit roofer, Diane Hendricks, who gave so much money to Walker, the Bradley Foundation. I mean, this is a case where the ideological right wing really came in force behind Pat Rogensack, and liberals, progressives, Democratic Party kind of, you know, took a dive on it and didn't spend money or didn't organize very much for Ed Filone. So I think it was a problem. I think Rogensack doesn't have a great record. She made a shameful defense of Justice Prosser, who would have been fired from any job in America other than being on the state Supreme Court when he chokes a colleague. And that's just outrageous. And she's also been the biggest friend to corporations in Wisconsin that they can buy.
Chris Lotto, why do these right-leaning groups put so much money in a Supreme Court race? Does that mean that they believe Justice Rogensack is going to rule their way?
No, I think it's groups speaking up. You know, look, put it this way: the idea that the state Supreme Court race or the WEAC race, giving away my true thoughts on the superintendent's race as well. You know, look, these are nonpartisan in name only, and I think everybody knows that, and anybody who's paying just a bit of attention understands that this really boils down to a Democrat versus Republican race. So it is not surprising to see conservative groups support what they view as a conservative candidate. I mean, that's exactly what happened here. Same as when Tony Evers is up for re-election and WEAC comes out of the woodwork and puts all their firepower behind him, and that's why he sails to victory by a wide margin against really a token Republican opposition.
Right. Evers said that his victory shows that the people of Wisconsin support their public schools, that they want fair public school funding, and they don't want an expansion of the private school voucher program. Do you think that's right, Matt?
Well, I think he's absolutely right about that, and I think he's done a good job standing up for our public schools, as Scott Walker is assailing our public schools at every opportunity. And you talk to people in Wisconsin, they do like their public schools. They do like their public school teachers, and they don't want to see their tax dollars go to just funneled into the pockets of people who are sending their kids to private schools. And so I think he was right on that. The money difference between Evers and Pridemore on direct contributions was $225,000 for Evers and $113,000 for Don Pridemore. According to the Democracy Campaign, Don Pridemore shelled out $68,000 of his own money. I found that to be astonishing and hadn't seen that figure before.
And on the state superintendent race, Chris?
Yeah, the governor said it this week, that the Evers win does not affect vouchers, and he's absolutely right. This was not some referendum on school choice expansion like those on the left would try to convince us. The race was simply this. It was a teachers' union-backed incumbent who sailed to re-election in a low turnout race against an underfunded token Republican opponent. To say that the results show some deeper-seated objections to the school choice overall, I think are reading way too much into what happened on Tuesday. Tony Evers winning re-election was about as surprising as the sun rising in the east.
All right, it was a mixed night on Tuesday night for Governor Walker's judicial appointees. His appointee in Dane County, Rebecca St. John, was defeated by attorney Rhonda Lanford. But in Milwaukee County, his appointee, Rebecca Bradley, won her race. Matt, the governor is now even saying maybe he's not going to appoint any judges to the bench in Dane County because they keep on getting defeated. Is Governor Walker a liability or an asset to judicial candidates in Wisconsin?
Well, in Dane County, he's a terrible liability. He's kind of poison. He's changed his mind again yesterday. He said, well, maybe I will appoint people, but they'll be retired judges or lawyers. I mean, you know, he might want to think a little bit before he speaks when he's angry, as he was on Wednesday with the results from the judgeship races. But look, I mean, people all over Wisconsin, and especially in Dane County, where you have so many public employees, have been suffering with wages down 4%, according to a recent study this week. You know, of course, people are going to look to see, you know, who was supporting Walker or who was appointed by Walker.
Chris?
Surprise, surprise. Liberal Dane County thinks that having Scott Walker attached to you is not a good thing. I mean, again, not necessarily surprising, but there were a lot of interesting things that happened in judicial races, you know, beyond the state Supreme Court this week. I mean, there was the Tom Wolfgram race in Ozaukee County. That's the judge who signed the Walker recall petition, and the judge himself was defeated by a wide margin right. this week, you know, because people viewed that as that, you know, Tom Wolfgram saying that he's not impartial. I mean, he signed a petition, got out there in a very public way, and the voters rejected that as well. So, you know, is it surprising that in Liberal Dane County they're saying we don't want to walk her back to, you know, appointee? No, that's not as surprising at all. But I think in other parts of the state they have a different point of view.
How about this Ozaukee County judge who got booted for signing a recall petition, Matt?
Well, I mean, it's not as liberal as Dane County. I mean, that's my conclusion. I mean, I think people should be able to express their political views, and it's just not true that people are without political views even when they put on a black robe. You can be an impartial justice and still, you know, want so-and-so elected or not elected or recalled or not recalled. And so I think people, you know, just assume that the ideal is to have someone be so impartial that they, you know, what, never vote?
There were some referendum questions on the ballot in some counties. For example, advisory referendums in Dane County and in the city of Milwaukee, or was it Milwaukee County, for support of same-day voter registration. Matt, no big surprises here.
People want same-day registration. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Scott Walker and Republicans who want to shrink the electorate and take the right to vote essentially away from as many people as possible who are likely to vote Democratic who don't want to see same-day registration.
Is that going to send a message to lawmakers in Madison, Chris?
Well, I think there are issues that deal more with fiscal concerns and how expensive it is to sort of change the process that will be kind of the overriding concern. I mean, it's no secret that Republicans in this state have been concerned for a long time about the extreme openness of our elections in this state and the possibility of fraud. And, you know, Republicans have been discussing that for years and have been trying to enact common sense measures to ensure that, you know, when you vote, your vote counts and it's not nullified by somebody casting a ballot illegally. So I think the results on this particular advisory referendum are not particularly surprising, but I think, you know, also Republicans remain concerned about dealing with that issue, the potential for voter fraud in the state.
And in Chippewa County, there was a question about Citizens United, Matt, and you thought that the results there were significant.
Yeah, this was the Citizens United decision of 2010 by the U.S. Supreme Court said, you know, corporations are persons, money is speech. We can't restrict corporations from spending whatever amount of money they want to run ads for this candidate, for that candidate, so long as they don't coordinate with the candidate or the candidate's campaign. And there's this huge movement around the country, which is one of the most exciting movements that I've seen in the last 20 years, to amend the Constitution to say that corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech and the government can regulate expenditures in political campaigns. And so in Chippewa County, as in hundreds of cities and counties in several states around the country, voters, by an overwhelming margin, said we should amend the Constitution to make it clear that corporations aren't persons. We need this if we're really going to have a democracy in this country.
Are you fully behind this movement, Chris?
I'm sorry, am I behind this?
Yes, I'm just kidding.
Okay, good. I'm like, wait, what? you know, I mean, okay, it's an advisory referendum in western Wisconsin, Chippewa County. I think you know, can subscribe as much or as little importance to that vote as you want. You know, it remains a contentious issue, obviously, and I know that's one that's important to Matt, but, you know, I don't know that an advisory referendum in one western Wisconsin county suggests some big sea change.
Patty in Eau Claire is with us. Hello, Patty.
Yes, I just wanted to say, you know, when you were talking about the judge races and Tony Evers, of course these were, I voted for Tony Evers because I knew I was voting against Scott Walker's voucher program. So to say that those things are not political was really fudging it. Your one guess when you asked, well, the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association and these conservative groups expect favorable decisions from Rogan Sack. Of course they do. I voted against her because I wanted to see decisions go more the way I want them. So let's pull it out of the closet and say it like it is. Our state is terribly divided, and it's showing up in any way we can voice our concern.
Patty, thank you very much. I'm going to let everybody think about that as we move on to an area where there is a lot of division. There was the first of four official public hearings on the proposed state budget yesterday. The next one will be Monday at Lambeau Field. Democrats say they are also going to hold some of their own hearings. Chris, tell us, do you generally support Governor Walker's budget, or are you in line with some other Republicans who think there's some problems there?
Well, and I assume you're referring
vouchers and
choice. Mm-hmm. Sure. I think in general the governor recognizes what needs to happen in the state in terms of curbing the spending problem that we have in this state by dealing with poor-performing districts that are not doing right by our kids in the state, and trying to find alternatives that help every kid in Wisconsin get a good education. I think it's a budget that has a lot of good ideas in it, and it's, let's face it, it is his perspective on how we ought to deal with these things. And obviously, a Democrat is going to have a different perspective on how you deal with that. I think particularly drilling down into the voucher issue, we are already hearing that some Republicans do not like the scope of what the governor is being proposed, and that's why we go through this process. There's going to be debate. There's going to be discussion. There's going to be an opportunity for the public to sound off. And it is very likely that the voucher program as proposed by the governor will not look the same as it does right now by the time it gets through the legislative process. So there definitely will be some shaping of what the governor has proposed.
And we have just a minute, Matt. What kind of shaping do you want to see?
Well, I just think we need to be clear. The Governor Walker is trying to destroy our public school system, and he's trying to funnel our tax dollars to private schools and parochial schools and even to rich parents he wants to give vouchers to, or the children of rich parents. And this is just an outrageous effort to attack one of the greatest institutions we have in the state. Our public schools have been great, and he's intent on destroying them.
Well, we're going to have more on the state budget hearing on our state capitol report on Monday after 7 o'clock. Time now to congratulate our quiz winner, Glenn in Stoughton, who answered correctly that the traditional sign-off at each episode of At the Movies with Siskel and Ebert was, "The balcony is closed." And congratulations to Glenn. The balcony indeed is closed. Chicago-based film critic Roger Ebert died yesterday at the age of 70 after a long battle with cancer. And I know, Matt, you had a very brief story in our limited time here about interviewing Roger Ebert.
Yeah, he was here 10 years ago and then more recently than that for the Wisconsin Film Festival. And when he was here, I was able to interview him for the Progressive Magazine. And he was, for a guy with his reputation, he was just so down-to-earth and affable. That's what I liked about him a lot. And he, obviously had this childlike love of movies. And when I was walking him back from the studio where we did the interview, I looked at the license plate on his car. It said movies.
Movies. Yeah. And you got to, if he said thumbs up, you had to go, right, Chris?
Yeah. I was a huge fan of the old TV show. I'm a lifelong movie fan. I remember watching that when I was like 10 years old, watching it on PBS. So it's really sad news. He really was an outstanding, movie critic.
Thank you, Chris Lotto, for being with us, and thank you, Matt Rothschild, as well.
Welcome, Joy.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come here on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.